All right, so we pick up our text in Mark 10, and it's towards the end of the three-year ministry of Jesus. And right before this passage, he is talking to his disciples about the reality that he was going to have to die in his ministry. The end of his ministry will be his death. And it's actually the third time in the Gospel of Mark that he talks about this. And they're not quite understanding and picking it up. In chapter 8 of Mark, the disciples confess and know that Jesus is Christ, the Messiah, the Holy One of Israel. In Mark 9, they've seen the transfiguration. They know his power. They worship him as God. They have seen Jesus heal people, cast out demons, know the future, read people's minds. And so James and John are the two main disciples in our passage, and they know Jesus really, really well. There were two of the three of what we call the inner circle. The remaining third one is Peter. And they're with every part of Jesus in his ministry. They're the ones that he confides in the most closely. He disciples them most intensely in every aspect of the ministry. And they're there for the transfiguration. Later on in the gospel, they're there in the garden. He asks them to come pray with him while the other disciples stay back. And so that's our context. I'm going to read the passage for you today. This is Mark 10, 35 to 41, and we'll read the remaining three verses in a little bit. And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to him and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us to sit one on your right hand and one on your left in your glory." Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism for which I am baptized?" And they said to him, "We are able." And Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink, and with the baptism for which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." And when the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. Mark 10, 35 to 41, the word of the Lord. So James and John have a request. Do for us whatever we ask of you. First, I want to impress upon you how big of an ask this is. They understand that Jesus can answer and do whatever it is they ask. And he doesn't even have to know what that is. And they know that he can do it. To kind of give you an analogy of what this looks like, it's like a checkbook. Pretend I'm Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, LeBron James, and you come up to me, Bill Gates, and say, "Bill, can you take out your checkbook, write my name at the top, your name, your signature at the bottom, and leave it blank? I'm not going to tell you how much money I'm going to put in there. I know you have a lot and you can handle it. I'm not going to tell you what the money is for, but I'd like you to do this for me. Bob White, please." That's the level of ask that James and John are giving right here. There's a great amount of assumption and pride in the statement from James and John. And as we see in Scripture, this is opposite of what Jesus has been teaching to date. Mark 9, 33 and 37, which is just a little bit earlier in our gospel, reads, "And they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, 'What were you guys discussing on the way?' But they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. And he sat down and called the 12. And he said to them, 'If any of you would be first, he must be last for all and servant of all.' And he took a child and put him in the midst of them. And taking him in his arms, he said to them, 'Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me.'" And so it's very possible that James and John are responding to this conversation just a chapter before, when they try to kind of sneak in here and get their what they want known. It's clear that the disciples have not heard this lesson to date. And so Jesus responds, and he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" Of course, Jesus is trying to get the specifics of, well, what is it that James and John wants? Notice that he doesn't say yes or no. He's capable. He's waiting to hear what it is they exactly want. And of course, Jesus knows and can read their heart and minds, and is not surprised by the response we are about to get. And they said to him, "Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." This is a fairly common phrase even today still. One at your right, one at your left is a position of power. It's saying, in military terms, it's the general's right-hand man and second-hand man. In Star Trek terms, if you ever watched Star Trek, it's the number one and the number two after the captain. that was supposed to be a joke. Thank you. There's a reality as we look at this that what James and John are asking is to be the next two in line behind Jesus in whatever his kingdom would look like. So in your glory, we think of the second coming. We think of the Son of Man coming on clouds, coming again to make all things right. James and John in this passage don't have that knowledge quite yet. It's been taught to them, but they're still thinking of a physical kingdom. They're thinking of this reality that that Jesus is going to overthrow Rome, set up a new kingship under him, and they want to be the next in line after Jesus. So what does Jesus say? "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drank and to be baptized with the baptism for which I am baptized?" Jesus calls them out and asks them a question back. What is this cup of baptism of Jesus? The cup is a reference to an Old Testament metaphor of the wrath of God being completely poured out, meaning God will not withhold full and absolute punishment. So take a glass of wine and imagine it being poured out to every drop. That's the full punishment of God. That is what Jesus is taking on. What is the baptism for which he is baptized? This is in reference to all of the pain, suffering, and sorrow that Jesus takes on to himself. And we see this in Isaiah 53, which I wanted to read for you. This is verses 4 and 5. Isaiah 53 is commonly known as the suffering servant passage. It's a direct metaphor or looking ahead to Jesus Christ. And so we see in verses 4 and 5, "Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteem him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed." And so we see in this passage that the reality that Jesus is coming and he's going to go to the cross and take the full weight of sin. And he's asking James and John, "Can you take the wrath of God? Are you able to go to the cross instead of me?" And of course, clearly the answer is no. But James and John express some ignorance to what exactly Jesus is talking about. And they respond, "We are able." And Jesus says to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink. And the baptism for which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or at my left is not mine to grant, but is for those for whom it has been prepared." And so he's actually predicting their futures here. But before we get to that, there's a reality that there's pride in James and John and all the disciples at this point, and it is swelling in them and how they respond and how they interact with Jesus. Remember where they come from. These were a bunch of people who kind of washed out of school, never made it to become rabbis, fishermen, tax collectors. They come from nothing. And Jesus chooses them. The Messiah chooses them. And Jesus can heal and cast out demons. Not only that, but Jesus gives his disciples the ability to heal and cast out demons. They've seen him transfigured. They know he's God himself. What does all this mean in their eyes? The disciples at this point think that they are really, really special. And so then Jesus kind of gives them a little bit of a check, but also this reality of what their future looks like. They will drink the cup and have the same baptism. This does not mean that they share in the atonement of Jesus Christ. It does not mean that they helped on the cross or that we today help on the cross. It does not mean that. Instead, it is a reference to what is going to happen to James and John. And so Acts 12, 1 and 2. Reads, and this is about James. About the time of Herod, the king laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church. He killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. And so James is going to die as a martyr, and Jesus alludes to this, that he dies and suffers for the church. We know that John in Revelation 1:9 talks about the fact that he is exiled to the island of Patmos, which is off of the it's off the shore of Turkey. And church tradition tells us he was also martyred for the faith. In fact, all of the disciples have great suffering and sorrow in their ministry for Jesus. Paul was shipwrecked multiple times. He was stoned. He was arrested, thrown in jail, martyred ultimately. And so there's a reality here that to share the glory of Jesus, we share in his pain. And this is what Jesus is alluding to. Verse 40. We know from the Matthew account of this gospel that that is the Father who sets who's going to be at the right and the left of Jesus. And then verse 41, and when the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant with James and John. Well, this is just showing the state of all of the disciples. Remember back to Mark 9:33, they were all fighting. A little bit later, James and John come and pull Jesus aside and try to elevate themselves to the first and the second behind Jesus. And when the rest of the disciples hear, they start to argue. They start to fight with each other. James and John are not alone in their pride. All of the disciples are struggling with this concept. They know they're going to do great things and be powerful and important in the kingdom. And Jesus kind of uses this fight as an occasion to teach him another lesson. And so our first point for today, James and John show great pride, yet everybody has pride like the disciples display in their lives. What do I mean by this? If we're being honest with ourselves in each one of our lives, it may look very different, but we all have some level of pride. This is part of being human and being sinful. Where do you see pride in your life? To give you some ideas, in my own life, I always want to be right. Whether it's theology, whether it's cars, and I know nothing about cars, whether it's what sports team I care about, whether the weather is going to be like tomorrow, I want to be right. I know that about myself. It's honestly, it comes down to pride. I don't like to be wrong. And so it's something that I've recognized and I have to fight in my own life. Where is that in your life? Let me give you some examples. I deserve to get that raise. Not that the other guy who's always late, you know, I do better work than him anyways. I got all A's last year, or my son or daughter got all A's last year. Did you see me shovel that neighbor's driveway? I try to do it every time there's need. Where do you see pride in your life? I serve on an important committee at my church. They need me. I received 100 likes on Facebook or Instagram for that picture of my kids. That one hits home for me because I love my kids. We all love our kids. We need to remember, God hates pride. Romans 1:30, Proverbs 16:5, Proverbs 21:4, 1 Timothy 3:6, 1 John 2:16, James 4:6. Pride and what God thinks of pride is all over the scriptures. Let me read you Proverbs 8:13. The fear of the Lord is hatred of evil. Pride and arrogance and the way of evil and perverted speech I hate. What's interesting in this passage is that Jesus does not rebuke their pride. Instead, he uses it as a teaching moment. He challenges them. He commands another way for believers to choose humility in love. Verses 42 to 45 is that other way, the way of God, that way which is humility and self-denial. But let me read the passage first before we continue. And Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever should be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." Mark 10:42-45. So 42 is Jesus's example of pride. The rulers of the world, they fight their way to the top any means necessary. Once they're there, the end justifies the means. However they need to, they will stay up there. The example of this in the time of the disciples would have been King Herod himself or the emperors of Rome. And you better believe that the disciples would have been thinking of those people as Jesus talks. For us today, it may be there are always people in both parties who just want to be in power, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, and they want that power and they don't really care about their job or what they're doing. It's just a means to an end. This may also be big business, corporations. Honestly, sadly, many churches work this way. And so Jesus is saying, "But it shall not be so among you." Is it so among you? It shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first must be slave of us all. So Jesus flips the conversation. He says, if you want to be great, be a servant. If you want to be first, be last. Again, this is not the first time he's taught the disciples this lesson. This is the time it begins to really sink in. But this is not the first time. So what does this look like? Caring and serving for your neighbors? Going the extra mile at work, not so that you can get a raise, but so that the person next to you can? Helping your friends, your family, and even your enemies when it's not easy or convenient? Really practically, letting someone else get the good parking lot at Walmart instead of you? That one's hard for me. So Scripture gives us two great examples of humble love. The first is Jesus washing the feet of the disciples, John 13. And this scene, we're not going to read the whole thing right now, but this scene is one where the God of the universe, not only has he come to earth, which is an act of humility itself, Philippians 2, but the God of the universe gets on his knees, takes out a cloth, and washes the dirt, the grime, the sweat, the excrement, and anything else that was found on the disciples' feet. They walked around in sandals back then. There was not a filtration system and a sewer system like we have today. And so those feet were gross. It was hard skin. It was not a pleasant sight. In fact, this was the lowest of low jobs for any servant in a household to do. And Jesus does it. We'll read the verse in a minute, but in verse 1, it is explicitly said that the service of humility is driven by love. The second great example is that Jesus dies on the cross for the sins of all humanity. This is the biggest example. Verse 45 makes that clear. For even the Son of Man is Jesus, came not to be served, but to serve. And so the Son of Man image is from Daniel, and this is the idea that the Son of Man comes down on clouds. It's talking about Jesus' second coming. And the Israelites and the disciples would see this as a statement of power. The sons of man came not to be served. He did not come to be served on, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Did you know that God doesn't need our service? He doesn't need that. He's God. But he came to ransom us. Payment made by liberation of people from slavery. Not money, but life given over. So it's not a cash payment, but it's a life for a life, or in this case, a life for many lives. It's a substitution. Yeah, why did God send Jesus to the cross? It is love that drives out drives our desire to serve, not pride, legalism, or God's need. So let me read some scriptures to you here. that will make this clear. John 13:1. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that this hour had come to depart of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Let me read that again. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And this is the passage right before the washing of the feet. Jesus washed the disciples' feet because he loved them. 1 John 3:16. By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. And then, of course, John 3:16, God so loved the world that he sent his son to die on the cross. Why did Jesus go to the cross? Because of his great love for each and every one of us. It is gratitude for what Jesus did on the cross for our sins that creates a desire to serve. Isaiah 53 speaks to this again. 10 and 11. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering of for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous. So it goes back to this idea of ransom. He's our guilt offering. He takes our sins unto himself. John 15:13, greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. We serve because we love. This is the why to service, because we are called to serve. But how about the how? How do we do it? Matthew 22:39, love your neighbor. How do we do that? How did the disciples get from being a group of 12 in our passage here who are arguing and bickering over who's going to be the greatest and who's going to have the most power to being the 12 who started the church, took it to the ends of the world, and suffered and mostly died along the way? How did that transformation happen? The how is also in the cross. The how and the why are both in the cross. Once he has ransomed our lives with his, he gives us the ability to choose humility versus pride. He gives us the ability to grow and become more like Jesus. And as we spend time with him and grow and mature, he builds in us a desire to serve out of love. An example of this, when I was in high school, I became a Christian my freshman year of high school. I didn't really come to this passage until I was a junior. And I don't know how many of you are aware of Young Life, but Young Life has this program where they reach out to high school students, and then as a hook and bait system, they try to get you to go to a really fun camp over the summer. And then the whole point of the camp is to have a whole ton of fun, and then you learn about Jesus and have an opportunity to accept Christ before the week is out. It's a good system. It works well with high schoolers because they come for the fun, and then they're like, whoa, what is this? I had no idea of my need. And so I wanted to go and have the fun, right? Because I was already a believer. I wanted to go and have the fun, but it's expensive. And so there was an opportunity to go and serve for a month. And in order to serve for the month, I had to take a class for a semester talking about Improving Your Serve by Charles Swindoll. And that book, this passage in Mark 10:45 is the key text that he uses. And my world just opened up when I got this concept that the cross is not only the why to our service, it was the how. Because before then, it was legalism. All I wanted to do was serve because I thought I was supposed to. Well, that's what good Christians do, is to serve. I didn't understand the love aspect of service. And so when I got this, I started to, for a high schooler, big steps, I started to clean my own dishes. I started to serve in the church that I was going to. I started to wash my own clothing, which again, you may laugh at that, but that was a big step for me. My mom noticed. She was like, what's different? She actually asked me about it. She was like, you okay? So this begs the first question for you today, for some of you. Has your life been ransomed by God? Are you a believer? Because if you're not a believer, you can't serve through love. You can serve and you can have another reason. You want to look good, pride, legalism. But if you want to serve through love, if you want to do what Christ has called us to do in this passage, then we have to be believers. Romans 3:23, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is death. John 10:9, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that he was raised from the dead, you will be saved. So for some of you, that's the first step you need to take if you want to serve in love, is you need to accept Christ. And I would urge you to do that today. I'll be here after the service and we can talk further if you want to work through some of these scriptures and pray about it. But if we don't know Christ, he can't change us. We won't understand the why or the how. For those of us who do know Jesus, how are you showing your love through service? Where are you serving? Are you serving your neighbors? Are you serving in a ministry here at church? Are you volunteering with a nonprofit? There are lots of opportunities to serve. You don't have to do all those things. You don't have to do any of those things. There's other ways to serve. But where are you serving? Who are you serving? If you're not serving anywhere here, we have lots of opportunities. We need help in our children's ministry. We need teachers, and we also need people who can just keep kids safe. We also need more people for our coffee bar. And our greeting, our first impressions ministry is looking for more people. There's other needs too. If those don't meet your need, again, we'd love to talk to you and kind of get you plugged in and connected. But you don't need to just serve here. This is the way to share the gospel. When you serve your neighbor who doesn't know Christ, like my mom, they start to ask the question, well, why did you do that? When you serve somebody you work with and they get the raise instead of you, they start to ask the question, what makes my boy different? And that opened up doors to share the gospel, to share the scriptures. And so that's why it comes out of love and not out of any other need. The point is not to serve because God needs our service. This was also a trap that I got into. You know, it's my response. Like, he saved my life, therefore I have to serve him. We forget how big the God of the universe is, who holds and sustains the whole universe. He does not need my service. That's not why he calls us to service. He calls us to service because it's a natural product of love. When we love, we serve. And when we keep that into proper perspective and we see that Jesus is the servant king, his love radically changes us. We begin to love like he loves through our service to our friends, our family, our neighbors, our enemies, to total strangers.
Thanks for joining us. If you have any questions about what we talked about, Jesus Christ, our church, or anything else, connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or by email. We'd love to hear from you.